You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, August 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Ann Lee, author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China, the question of China's economy, perhaps on the brink. Also on the program today, court case in the, or I should say, determining the state of play of DAPA, the deferred action for parents of Americans. One case down, others to go. Rest in peace to Julian Bond. Meanwhile, a man arrested in a clinic bombing attempt in Kansas. And the Republican race continues. A multitude now of Republican candidates have put forth the proposition of repealing parts of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution on birthright. This is Trump is still running the election based upon what he said at his opening press conference. It's unbelievable. And not only is Trump still way ahead in the polls, I think he's now sort of in a better shot position than he was pre-debate, just because everybody else has fallen so far behind him. He's now going after the ethically and follically challenged Frank Luntz. Folks,
he's destroying him.
There's not enough, well, I want to say popcorn, but really I should be eating, you know, just vegetables and just some carrot sticks and whatnot and some celery in the world for me to sit back and enjoy this much. But I will continue. A new study shows that gun ownership and uncontrollable anger correlate. That should not make you feel very good. Let's just talk about that study. So a new study has come out. Oh, I guess this was actually from back in April, but I just saw it. Somebody must have sent it to me, because I don't remember reporting it at the time. The Los Angeles Times reported on it back in April. It was psychology researchers from Duke, Harvard, and other universities. And they found that a large number of individuals in the United States self-report patterns of impulsive, angry behavior and also possess firearms at home. That's 8.9%. Or carry guns outside the home. Guess this was a decade-long study of 5,500 Americans. 9% of people in the United States have both guns and significant anger issues. I don't know that there's any causal connection there, but it's nice to know that those two things correlate, doesn't it? All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to hear a lot about China, as that seems to be what Donald Trump likes to talk about. So all the Republican candidates are going to be talking about it. And supposedly China's economy could very well be on the brink. I wanted to find out more. And so when we come back, we'll be talking to Ann Lee, NYU professor and author of What Can the U.S. Learn from China? We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. NYU Professor Ann Lee, author of What the U.S. Can Learn from China. Welcome to the program, Ann.
Thanks for having me.
So now I don't know terribly much about China. I do know that there have been news reports that their economy is in a very bad place now, and people seem to consider that to be largely problematic for the rest of the world. Give us a sense of what's going on in broad strokes in terms of the Chinese economy.
Well, it has slowed a little bit. The latest reports about their imports and exports show that they were down about 8%, which was worse than what people expected. But I think the media reports that the economy is in big trouble is really exaggerated. This is an economy that has been growing for over 30 years straight up, you know, in for the most part in double-digit growth. And in the last few years at like, you know, 7% and maybe drifting a little lower to, you know, below 7 this year. But this is extremely strong. I mean, you know, in the best of worlds for the U.S., I mean, we were, you know, considering our economy strong at 4%. And so, you know, the new normal for China is still amazingly high growth rate. And for an economy that large, because it's the second largest economy in the world at such a high growth rate, I think it is fair to say that it's slow, but it's not in trouble. And so this doesn't feel bad news for the rest of the world. In fact, it could be great news for the rest of the world because they're transitioning into a consumer-driven economy where consumer-driven consumption and services are finally becoming a larger part of their GDP. Over 50% is in services now, which means that other countries can export to China, and that could be a destination for exports as opposed to the U.S. playing that role alone. And so this is, I think, great news, a story that's not really shared in the media. I think that when people talk about China, they tend to exaggerate it because so few people in the States have visited China, so they don't know what to believe. And when you create anxiety and fear, it creates volatility in stock markets and currency markets, and this is good news for Wall Street traders, but that's not necessarily an accurate picture.
So, okay. So, is that why, and I want to get back to sort of the way that the economy is changing from sort of an export-based economy to one that actually a lot of the spending actually happens and the sales end up happening to their own sort of domestic market. But, why is it that when the idea that Chinese growth will slow, why is there this reaction? Is it simply because of that volatility? I mean, because I could also add, like, to all of the sort of the economic factors you're talking about, why that might be a positive thing. It's also sort of, it seems to me, at least somewhat positive in terms of climate change. Because I mean, theoretically, you know, that growth is also, in many respects, is arguably costing the planet a little bit as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a healthy transition, and I've said on other news shows that, you know, economy can't grow at super high rates forever. It's just not sustainable, and it, you know, every economy sort of has growth spurts and slows down, including the U.S. And so China's just having a slower patch right now, but that doesn't mean that the economy is in danger. And why people make a big deal out of it, I wonder sometimes, you know, people might have, you know, sort of their own political agendas about talking down China, sort of denying their successes, you know, because it's convenient for their other political purposes. And so, you know, I can't speculate on all the reasons why, you know, some people, you know, would spin it in a certain negative way. But, you know, this is starting to be another presidential season where candidates, you know, need to figure out who can be a punching bag. And China's always been the perennial favorite lately. And so they'll use any excuse to try to say, you know, there's something wrong going on there and blame that country for what's going on.
I mean, the interesting thing to me is that part of what we're seeing, at least to the extent that we've seen China come up in the presidential election so far, is they are an all-knowing, very cunning. I mean, I think this is what Donald Trump has said, like, you know, they're running circles around us. And are leaving us in the dust. I mean, I don't know what all of that's supposed to necessarily mean when you actually talk about real things, but that's sort of the imagery that he's trying to evoke. When the Chinese economy slows down, or actually, more importantly, sort of turns at least inward in terms of it functions as much on domestic consumer spending as it does on exporting, or at least that that proportion begins to come closer to 1-to-1. What are the implications for the U.S.? What are the implications for the rest of the world?
The implications for the U.S. is that you know, China is no longer a place for Fortune 500 companies to get cheap manufacturing. So companies already have started outsourcing to other places like Vietnam or Mexico instead of China to do their manufacturing. They basically have seen that, well, you know, the labor wages are too high there. So instead of using them for the back end, they're actually selling goods to them because there's a growing middle class in China. They're spending more. And so this becomes a great destination for exports, not only for the U.S. companies, but for the entire world. And so this can really pull a lot of economies out of the doldrums. And, you know, it's up to those countries to take advantage of that. And I think that also with a growing middle class in China, it means that they are going to not only buy American goods, but they're also going to be traveling more abroad, and they can spend their tourist dollars here in the U.S. also. And so that also spells not only, you know, economic potential not just for exporting industries, but also in the domestic industries, you know, restaurants and other places where tourists want to spend their money.
And what of the currency manipulation? I mean, the devaluing of their currency, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago now. Give me your sense of is it as problematic as we are led to believe in this country? What are going to be the implications in terms of how does that impact, let's say, our exports to China?
First of all, I think that currency manipulation is complete misnomer, because all these talks about currency wars really started here in the U.S. when the Federal Reserve decided to engage in quantitative easing right after the financial crisis. They were the first to create the currency war because all that money printing caused the U.S. dollar to fall dramatically as soon as the Fed engaged in that activity. And the rest of the world couldn't handle that kind of pressure, and so everyone else followed suit. So the euro basically depreciated. Also, you know, they cut their interest rates to even negative rates. Japan depreciated their currency significantly. China literally was the last one standing with no currency depreciation, and they were actually appreciating against all their major partners, you know, as much as 60% appreciation. And this, frankly, you know, has hurt China's exports significantly. But even, you know, with this giant appreciation of China's currency, they were still able to gain share in trade. So they demonstrate in real world terms that prices are not the only thing that determine trade competitiveness. There are so many other things that will, you know, give a company or a country an edge, such as their productivity, the quality of what they're exporting, and so many other factors. And so, so actually China was doing quite the opposite. They were not engaging in currency manipulation, and what they're doing here is that it's what the U.S. has been asking them to do all along, which is to let the currency follow the market forces more. And the market for the Chinese yuan actually had been falling. The spot market for where the currency trades was below where the policymakers were trying to prop it up. And they finally said, well, you know, there's so much pressure for it to go down because of the weak economic numbers coming out of China that they said, okay, we'll just let it drop a little bit. So, you know, 2% fall, you know, in those last couple of days, it is nothing compared to the extreme appreciation it had experienced in the last few years since the credit crisis. And so that's really not going to put a dent on any country's exports competitiveness against China. You know, it would take a much more dramatic fall of China's currency to really affect its trading partners. But at this rate, I think it's more just a signal that they're sending as opposed to having any material effect.
And let me ask you this in terms of, you know, when we hear about economic numbers, I think it was Paul Krugman the other day wrote that most or economic statistics are, you know, at best partially fiction. And he's suggesting that Chinese numbers are also sort of rather fictional. Just we don't have any type of real sense of what's going on. They don't necessarily have the most transparent. And I would argue to a certain extent, neither do we. But theirs are less transparent. Give me your take on that perspective.
My perspective is it takes one to know one, and for Krugman to accuse China's numbers as being fiction, all you need to do is just look at U.S. numbers to know that ours is practically no different. A lot of the numbers that come out of you know, our statistics have been manipulated by economists as well, because when you look at where the consumer price inflation indices and all that, if something in the indices is higher than normal, they basically substitute it with something else, what they call a comparable. So if Apple prices were showing inflation and they don't want to let anyone know that there's really inflation going on, they substitute apple for, you know, pears for apples.
Right.
And so, you know, we do just as much manipulation on our statistics as, you know, any other country. And so, so if you're talking about apples to apples, I don't think that the Chinese numbers are so much worse. And in fact, there are plenty of American companies that track Chinese numbers as well, doing their own independent research, polling CEOs of, you know, thousands of companies around China. And frankly, the numbers that they report, whether it's the Beige Book or some other groups that track Chinese economic numbers, they're basically saying that, you know, whatever the China government is reporting is actually pretty on target to their own results. So, you know, I don't think that the numbers are terribly off. I mean, yes, there can be variations here and there, but for the most part, I think the Chinese government numbers are as true as it can possibly be.
I know we don't have too much time here, but let me just ask you a couple other questions so that we all have as you say, I think we're going to hear a lot more about China in the coming elections in this country, just because I think you know that seems to be what Donald Trump wants to talk about, so everybody ends up talking about it. One of the stories I've been seeing quite a bit recently is that Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, has been, or I guess there have been a lot of corruption cases. I don't know, maybe a lot is the, but there have been some corruption cases of note in the higher echelons of the Chinese government. I'm curious what accounts for that? I mean, I got to presume, is it? I presume it's not a rash of new corruption necessarily, but rather an attempt to crack down on corruption. Is that a function of Xi Jinping looking to get rid of political competition, or is that a function of trying to project a certain perspective to the rest of the world in terms of looking for investment?
I think he's accomplishing both. He wants to send a message to the Chinese public as well as folks abroad that they're serious about trying to clean up corruption in China. And conveniently, it can also serve as a way to get rid of political opponents at the same time. So I think that there was a little bit of both that was going on. And it was a necessary step because before Xi Jinping took power, there was widespread cynicism and, you know, perception amongst even the Chinese that the government, the high government officials were above the law. They were too privileged to be touched, and they can get away with everything. And that was going to hurt the credibility of the government, and they knew that they couldn't stay in power if that was going to be widespread enough and people were, you know, too cynical to listen to them. And so he needed to act forcefully because the previous administration, if they ever cracked down on people, it was just on lower-level government officials. And so there was a common saying where they said, you know, the people, they just swat the flies, but they leave the tigers, you know, running loose. Meaning that, you know, the powerful ones get away and only the small guys get, you know, hurt. And so Xi Jinping turned that all around by going after a lot of the big tigers, you know, namely the high government officials that were caught in various scandals. And this actually, you know, lifted the spirits of the common people in China, as well as basically sort of put a lid on corruption because all the government officials were, frankly, finally fearful that they would be next. And so it really served two purposes there.
I feel like the swatting the flies and leaving the tigers alone could have application in our society. But that's a different question. So let me ask you lastly. I mean, does Xi Jinping, when we talk about his political rivals, is the idea of sort of, I guess, you know, good government on some level is what he's talking about here. In weeding out corruption and laying down the law, as it were, and saying that no one is above the law, at least to the extent that he's doing that, are his rivals? I mean, is there an ideological divide, or is it simply, sort of standard fare politics and maybe some measure of, you know, we need to impose a certain level of technocratic legitimacy to this government to maintain our political power? Or is there any type of like ideological differences within the Communist Party?
There are going to be differences in all sorts of things. When you have a Communist Party that is at least 80 million members, everyone is going to have their own opinion, clearly. And especially the people in the Politburo and above, they're going to all, you know, be jockeying for power. And the ideological differences usually are no different than for any other country. It's usually the haves versus the have-nots. It's the age-old problem forever in human history. And you have it in China very clearly, because you have very rich cities along the coast, and you have the poor peasant folks on the west part of China, and they're going to have very different needs and want very different things. Clearly, the poor people, you know, would want more welfare. They would want more help. The rich people don't want to be taxed more. So it's the same struggles that any other country is going to be faced with, and that those are the same debates and, you know, that go on in China.
Interesting. Well, Ann Lee, NYU professor, author of the book What the U.S. Can Learn from China. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks again.
Bye-bye. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, I think...
I'm just shocked to find out that the stuff that Donald Trump is going to be talking about when it comes to China is going to be total BS.
Oh, really? I didn't get that from the interview. I got that Trump is exactly right, and he's calling him out because he knows how to make deals. And the Chinese know how to make deals, and he'll make deals with the Chinese. He thinks the Chinese are lovely people, but they're running circles around us, and we can't allow it to happen anymore.
I know we've got some sound.
Trumpified here.
I know we've got some sound, and we're going to get to it. And I know that this is not the fun half, but this is too fun for me not to share. Literally, it is so rare. Like, usually what happens when we prep for the day, I'm here prepping. 3 or 4 hours later, Michael waltzes in, either hungover or, you know, sweaty from his yoga workout or whatever it is.
Not a yoga workout.
And whatever. And... and I am... I am knee deep in pieces of long form pieces or whatever it is I'm reading.
I'll explain how it really goes
Michael
down
is,
on the next M&M
right,
Monday.
Right.
Go ahead.
And Michael's sitting there giggling because he's watching some video. It turns out to be like he's actually ostensibly looking at video that we're supposed to play on the program, or sound, I should say. And it ends up being just like some Keenan Peele, sketch or... something from like, oh, this is the latest Amy Schumer, whatever it is, that I'm like, okay, that's great, but we can't, that doesn't, but nevertheless, today, I could not stop giggling as I read this story, apparently, and I will admit, I did not follow this little part of the story. And later in the program, we'll talk about how Trump's poll numbers are huge. We will talk about the question as to whether or not not only is Trump's numbers really big, but what is the really most interesting dynamic now is that the Trumpites, if you will, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Huckabee, like the people who are supposedly the embarrassments of the Republican Party. Now, frankly, I think they're all embarrassing. But I'm talking now from the mainstream perspective, the ones who could never win. And I go back to the book Stephen Sherrill and I wrote in 2006 now, which was the Republican Party. Those on the margin are now taking over the Republican Party. And granted, there's been two presidential elections since then, but we are really seeing it come to fruition now. The Trumpite wing of the Republican Party, which is, I don't know if you can call it a wing. It's really like the fuselage of the Republican Party is now polling better than the supposed establishment reasonable wing. And believe me, when guys like Lindsey Graham and Scott Walker are supposed to be your reasonable wing, you've got a problem.
I'm just so sad that I just have to say that we have to bomb Libya, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and I'll just throw Guatemala in there, too. I don't hate Muslims. It's not all them, but I'm just so sad about it. And we got to defund Planned Parenthood, and we got to consider dropping a nuke on the Palestinian territories.
Yes, but what about the ground forces?
Oh, we need about 60,000 additional troops and a whole brigade and a division, all sorts of other fancy military men over there. And if you don't like that, I'm not your candidate. I learned all I need to know about them when I was running a pool hall back at my daddy's. Also, black people. Did I say that out loud?
Okay. So aside from all that,
Trump is not
just causing the Republican candidates to go down these wormholes they will never be able to escape. Rubio, Walker, publicly saying they don't believe there should be a rape exception to their abortion bans. It's obscene. It's obscene. They are calling for the forced pregnancy of rape victims. Now, that's going to be a real problem in the general election. They think it's their lifeline in the Republican primary, but that's going to be a real problem in the general election. When Scott Walker comes out and says, I have the same immigration policy as Donald Trump, that's going to be a real liability in the general election. This is just going to keep happening and happening. Okay? Aside from that, what we're also seeing Trump do is destroy the infrastructure in the Republican Party. Like, Fox is, he's like, Trump is like basically taking this huge steel beam and just slamming it against the scaffolding of, it's still going to be there. It's just going to be this twisted mess. And now, after having sent, what's her name? Megyn Kelly? Is that her name? Yeah. Megyn Kelly. On an early vacation. Yeah, I've even already forgotten who she is. Donald Trump's feud with GOP pollster Frank Luntz escalated yesterday. Why did this happen? Well, Luntz, apparently at a Koch brothers retreat, said that Trump and Democratic presidential insurgent Bernie Sanders, they love to pair those two up, are delivering a big F-U to the elites in America. Luntz said, but F-U doesn't solve anything. F-U doesn't make life any better. The idea of Frank Luntz complaining. No, the idea of Frank Luntz complaining about just rhetoric as opposed to policies is hilarious. F-U makes you feel good, but it doesn't get you where you need to go, whatever that empty platitude means. Where you need to go? What the hell does that mean? F-U doesn't make America strong. I think probably to the extent that any politician ever said it, it was because Frank Luntz focus tested it and found that, yeah, that works. Right. F-U doesn't solve anything. Trump then responded to Politico. If I was Fox News president Roger Ailes, I'd fire that guy so fast for what he did, his head would spin. So people at the gathering, which was organized by the Koch brothers, said that Luntz argued that Trump is not a true conservative, but is addicted to the limelight and is likely to become increasingly enticed by the prospect of launching a third-party presidential bid the longer he stays in the race. First off, 75% of the people in the Republican race are almost without a doubt addicted to the limelight. Frank Luntz, no longer eating his penny vodka in his palatial abode, his spaghetti bolognese. It's come out of his little fox den. He's gone on lunch to say Trump has tapped into it, Bernie Sanders has tapped into it, and they're doing well, but they're tapping into fire. That's how hot the anger is. We're in a dangerous political environment that requires a higher standard for the candidates running. It requires them not just to stroke the anger, it's already there. It requires them to provide the balm of solutions. Let me tell you something. Frank Luntz is the pollster who developed the whole rhetorical side of what we know as the modern Republican Party. He was there I can't even remember his name now, who ran last time.
Contract
Newt Gingrich. Yes.
Yeah.
Newt Gingrich. Their whole revolution. Slashing Social Security. Taking food out of kids' mouths. Calling the Democratic Party Democrats. Because it sounds like rat at the end. That's the guy who developed it. And he's now complaining about it. He's now complaining about it. Luntz said, when he denied the allegation that he had been doing this, he said, you got to understand that I don't care who wins and loses. I only care that I'm accurate. This is a guy who was censured by his own polling association for being ethically challenged in the whole Contract for America and fabricating numbers. Trump responded by branding the focus group that Luntz ran as a dumb panel and calling Luntz a low-class slob. Luntz is a clown. He's got absolutely no talent whatsoever. He came to my office looking for money. He wanted to represent me in a corporate capacity, which I had no interest in whatsoever. The last thing I need is focus groups from Frank Luntz, who can't get himself arrested. When I had no interest in hiring him, he went on to do some negative focus groups on television. And frankly, he shouldn't be working for Fox because he's a total conflict of interest. Sorry.
It's true. It's all true.
It's all true. And then Luntz comes back with, this is not a game. It's not a joke. All these candidates have to take what they say seriously. Says the man who cared nothing but for messaging until he was sitting on his couch eating his spaghetti bolognese, trying, I think, to get into sports or Hollywood, and no one would hire him. And he obviously, on that trip, on that tour, stopped by Trump's office. Trump said no, and now Trump has him dead to rights. I'm sorry, folks. I know I shouldn't be enjoying this much, but I do. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. I don't know how it gets any funner than that. We'll take your phone calls. We'll take your IMs. And we will play some sound for you. I just love now also. We'll talk about this latest CNN poll. And now we're starting to see. As I don't know if I predicted, but I certainly hoped. On the day that Trump was announced his candidacy, we're starting to see stories, at least from some quarters, about how there's no real difference between Republican policies and Trump policies. And to the extent that there is, it's only because Trump is like addressing the obvious and widely shared beliefs that we shouldn't cut Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. That's right. Trump, the voice of reason, shares more with the Republicans than any of the other candidates on the stage. It's fantastic. All right, we're going to take a quick break. 646-257-3920. Hey, don't forget, this show relies on its members for 98.7% of our revenue. Of course, it ebbs and flows. Sometimes it goes from 99.7 down 97.9. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We have people who leave us because of financial constraints on any given week. And if you're one of those people without those constraints, but you like listening to the show on a regular or semi-regular basis, please think about supporting the show. You pay a lot more for the other crappy, low-rent entertainment options you have in your life. It's a cost of it's less than a movie a month now, I think we're at. You get all this entertainment and news.
Yeah, stop attacking the coffee. Start attacking all this other cultural garbage out there.
Yeah.
That sucks your money down, and it's right. Terrible.
Oh, just wait for the movie to show up on Netflix, folks. Don't go out to that theater. Come on. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And after all you've heard from, all you've heard about Amazon, if you still insist on purchasing stuff from Amazon, the least you can do is deny Jeff Bezos a couple of pennies per transaction by going to majorityreportkickback.com, clicking on the link, bookmarking it. And if you buy stuff from Amazon, buy it through that link. Also, give us a good review on iTunes. That really makes a difference. At least it does in my demeanor and my sense of worth. And I don't mind an occasional bad. I shouldn't even say that because there's a lot of people going to be like, oh, well, okay, in that case. See you tomorrow, folks. Or I should say, see you in the fun half.